Chanctonbury Ring is a Sussex landmark. It's on the edge of the South Downs Way, north of the seaside town of Worthing, and visible from great distances from all sides. Its iconic crown of beech trees was part of its identity and status as a landmark, but those were laid low by the Great Storm of 1987. The ring has endured nonetheless, having a character and quality that stretches way back into the distant forgotten past. The archaeological record defines Chanctonbury as a place of significance going back at least 2,500 years. As well as its physical presence, Chanctonbury occupies a place in the imaginary landscape too. Since the original beech trees were planted over 260 years ago, poets, writers, musicians, artists, wizards, archaeologists, Morris dancers and occultists have all been drawn to the place. This episode was an attempt to make a portrait of Chanctonbury. Every approach I made led me down a different path, so I'm just letting all the different voices speak for the hill, and you can find your own way through it. Most of the recordings took place from April to June 2019, as the spring gave way to the summer. I'll credit everyone properly at the end, but for now, join me as we make our way up onto Chanctonbury Ring.
Me, my dad and my mum are here, and we're exhausted. It was a very long walk. And then it was like the wind was so strong, it could like blow you off your feet. And then it was like, oh God, oh no, there's more now. We came up from the car park and we went all the way along up and down the hill, and I got really, really tired. And then when we got to the top, there was like these few minutes of absolute hell where you were just fighting a losing battle, really. And then we got into the forest and it was all right. The end. It says that if you walk anti-clockwise 7 times, you're going to summon the devil.
So local legend has it that Chanctonbury Ring was created by the devil, and the devil can be summoned by running around the clump of trees 7 times anti-clockwise. When he appears, he will offer you a bowl of soup in exchange for your soul. That's one story.
Well, I think a little bowl of soup for your soul is a pretty big demand, if you ask me. I mean, like, you'd think the devil at least plays fairly with his games. Well, I guess he is the devil, but I mean, come on, he couldn't have made it easier to reach or something. Like, maybe a staircase, that would have been nice.
I think there are some stories say that he also grants you a wish.
Oh, I like a wish.
In exchange for your soul.
Oh, no, thank you. No, thanks. I think I'd keep my soul this time.
You sure you don't want a quick try and summon up the devil?
Oh, I don't fancy soup right now. Maybe another day.
7 quick laps around the trees.
I've had enough of exercise for one day.
Okay, the devil will have to wait.
Yes, please. Who knew summoning the devil would be such exhausting work?
It was a sort of turning point in my study of folklore. I'd studied Scandinavian folklore, and one day, it was in 1968, I had some work being done in the house here, and the workmen were talking about what the countryside used to be like, and they mentioned Chanctonbury, and one of them said about that if you run around it, the devil comes out and gives you a bowl of soup, and the other said, oh, no, you've got it wrong, what he gives you is a cup of milk or something. And they started discussing, and I thought, well, here am I, carefully studying Icelandic stories, and damn it, they are some just near me. I remember my dad saying, I remember Anne saying, yes, there would be enough for a little article. And the little article grew and grew, and eventually became a book. And there we were.
I think that there are interesting things. going on in terms of, you know, obviously the sorts of stories that become associated with the place. A lot of them, whether people meant them as truths or not, they're basically good stories, and that's what we do with places, and it's what we do with, you know, our own lives as well. We just, whether we're telling the truth or whether we're just creating something that's interesting, certain places just seem to generate more interesting stories. You know, if a place becomes associated with magical stories, mm-hmm. then people are going to come to the place with an
expectation.
Sense that they're going to experience something magical, and they do, and then they tell more stories. And
Chanctonbury is an interesting one. I think the thing about Chanctonbury is people know it's ancient, and there's been a lot of activity there. We know there's human remains been found there. There's lots of stories that have grown up about it. And I've sat up there before. If you're looking out to the east and there's no one around, you feel like you're being watched. You do feel like someone's watching you from the trees. I think it's something about having being on the top of the down, but being in tree cover, where you're... It's a very sort of unique little environment you're in, because it can be very windy and blustery, or it can be totally dead silent, totally still. But you're right on the top of these hills. I mean, I love the story about the, you know, seeing a Saxon looking for his gold, you know, and all the rest of it. But apparently he stopped appearing after the Washington pennies were found, you know, and this kind of thing. I love the local folklore. But I mean, would I camp up Chanctonbury Ring by myself? I don't know, if I had a few enough beers, I might do.
Yeah.
So many people now think that it's an evil place.
Yeah.
And it isn't. It's a it was a lovely place when I was young. As a child, Chanctonbury was a place to which one went out on picnics and so on. So I have sort of one set of childhood memories of Chanctonbury. The first local store that I knew as a child was connected with Chanctonbury Ring. And I remember very well my dad telling me, you know, nobody knows how many trees there are, and if you count them, you never get the same answer twice. And if you did count, get the right number by any chance, it would raise the ghost of Julius Caesar and all his armies coming marching over the hill from Sisbury, because that was where he landed, which it wasn't. And I think my dad knew perfectly well that it wasn't.
One time I went to Chanctonbury in January, it was about 6 years ago, and it was a miserable day. I mean, it was raining, it was windy, it was misty. And just you come over that lip as you're coming in from the south, and then suddenly Chanctonbury's there, with all the green and the grass around it, above the clouds. Now imagine if people would have seen that happening, then people would think, that's where we're going to build our temple. This is up in with the gods kind of thing.
Said ritual, I actually was thinking about how, you know, you said they found like temples. Well, I think it would have been some kind of, because you said it was like, you know, it's like there's loads of wind, like I don't think they would have left animals here. They had better places to keep the animals, but here it seems more like since it's high, like it kind of gives a bit of a sense of importance, and then when you think about it, you could have like, I think that there was like a burial ground, like a temple for like, you know, like tribe chiefs or, you know, that kind of thing, rulers, because like, you know, it can be seen from like quite far, so people kind of knew that like it was important, because the height gives a sense of importance.
The origins of these hill forts are really, if you just try and understand them in terms of defence as forts, you're not going to get very far, because it's more about statements in the landscape. It's about enclosing and protecting things at certain times. But people aren't living here. There's no evidence of huts and circles.
Oh, really?
It might be places to bring people and bring game. It might be places for annual game roundups. But always, the thing about these is the statement they make in the landscape. You've got this incredible view.
Yeah.
But also, that entire view's catchment is looking at this hill.
Yeah.
And what does that mean about the ability of the people who made it to work together to
it's
make
like Trump
that.
Tower, basically.
Yeah. But you may think of it in a more collective way. You know, we can self-organise ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, don't mess with us.
Yeah,
not necessarily don't mess with me.
Yeah.
Well, it's a multi-phase site, so we've got there's evidence of Neolithic flint working. In the Bronze Age, of course, you've got numerous burial mounds being built across there. In the early Bronze Age, so around 2000 BC, you have one of the burial mounds was excavated. On the west flank of the hill was found to have a female burial with a Wessex-style bronze dagger, which is pretty early. And in the later Bronze Age, you get a cross dike being built. Now, there's actually a cross dike on either side of the hill, which essentially is delineating a special area. Everything within that, you've got a lot more burial mounds and everything else, and you obviously have the actual enclosure, which was built probably in the early Iron Age, so around 600 BC, 700 BC. But the interesting enough, one of these cross dikes, only one of them has actually been properly dated. Nearly all of them are thought to be late Bronze Age, early Iron Age, but one of them has been dated to the Roman period. So it could well be you had a cross dike, or maybe a Bronze Age one that came slightly infilled, and then when the Romans come along, they recut it or cut a new one. The early Iron Age, they build the enclosure at the top. Mm-hmm. We don't really know what it was for. There have been pits found there of human remains and pottery, so it could have had some kind of religious function. It almost certainly isn't a hill fort in the sense of a defensive position. There's no chance you're going to have any water supply up there. And even at its height, when it was first built, the ditches and the banks aren't really substantial enough for anything like that. Then it's abandoned about 400 BC, which is almost exactly the same time that Cissbury is built. So it's almost like there's a conscious decision by the local tribes or the local tribe to move the focus of one of their areas from Chanctonbury, and they go down to Cissbury and build this massive hill fort, second largest in the country. Then there's not really much happening until the Romans arrive. Then you get the first temple being built, which is a classic square in a square with the Keller. And within that, we don't know exactly what was going on, of course. And then you get the second temple being built, about 60 foot to the southwest of the first one, all within this early Iron Age enclosure. And the second temple is a very odd design. It's polygonal, it's got numerous sides, and it had a porch projecting out to the east.
At that point, Romano-British period, this is ancient. This is old.
Yeah.
This is the ancestors. This is my great-great-grandfather, you know?
Yeah.
That used to be, you know, his. So you get the temples here, you get the temples on Lansingring, you get the temple at Muntham Court.
Mm.
There's something going on down the bottom of this hill. That it becomes an agricultural landscape, a productive Roman agricultural landscape, but the fringes and the margins of it are given over to the gods
and
the spirits.
Amazing.
And that's where the temples come in, and a pig cult going on here. You know, all of these temples have a lot of pig bones, and around here you've got a kind of epicenter of finding these little pig figurines. They're not boars.
Really?
They're pigs.
Right.
Yeah?
Wow.
Pig cult.
Yeah. Sussex pig cult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw Sussex pig cult once. The early stuff's better.
Sussex pig cult.
You heard from my daughter, Anouk, folklorist Jacqueline Simpson, musician Sharon Krause, archaeologists James Sainsbury and Matt Pope, and the author and fan of Sussex pig cult, Justin Hopper. More from Justin and Sharon later. Chanctonbury, all things to all people. It's been used, forgotten, rediscovered, defended, loved, feared and revered longer than we know. I can't quantify what it is about the place, but certainly the wind and the trees seem to play a large part in defining the character of the hill and the ring itself. I went up to the ring on the morning of the 1st of May with the Chanctonbury Morris men to celebrate the start of summer and see another side of the hill.
We normally at this time of day on May the 1st sing a traditional song to welcome in the Mayo. Songs, folk songs are always better if everybody joins in.
Come and join us.
Come in, we don't bite, we smell, but we don't bite.
I wasn't going to say anything.
Come on.
Oh yeah. And the dogs can join in too.
Yes. And if you know this, then join in. And even if you don't know
this,
then join in.
We're going to start with the chorus. We'll start with the chorus.
Okay, alright. The grass where you are.
You're going to do it, Virginia?
Yeah, we're going to do it.
Bear the scorn to wear the horn. It was the crest when you were born. Your father's warrior.
Long before the day, oh, to welcome in the summer. To welcome in the day, oh.
The summer is coming, and winter's gone away, oh. What happened to the Spaniards that made so great a boast, oh? They shall eat the feathered goose, and we shall eat the roast, oh. Alonzo, jolly rumbelo, we were up long before the day, oh, to welcome in the summer, to welcome in the May, oh.
When did you join?
January, February time.
Yeah.
My neighbour got me into it. He was a bit of a madman. He does all sorts of stuff. And my wife sadly passed away just before Christmas. And he said, I'm going to get you doing stuff that you've never done before. And he said, we're going to go Morris dancing. We had a few drinks over a few pints over a few times. And he took me along to one of the practices. And these guys are a real welcoming bunch. Yeah. Yeah, it's good fun, it's good exercise. It's really hard work actually. People think, oh, yeah, what's that? Yeah. But we do a practice for 2 hours on a Wednesday night. And you come out of it absolutely knackered. And the first couple of times I did it, the following day, aches and pains and strains.
Yeah.
The older guys have been doing it for years, they just take it in their stride.
I've noticed you're dressed slightly differently from everybody else.
No, they're all dressed wrong, you see. That's what it is. No, Morris sides have lots of different roles and responsibilities in the side. We have a squire who's in charge,
yeah,
in theory. We have a captain who keeps the standard of the dance up. We have a bagman, who's a secretary, and you have a fool. And these guys seem to suggest that I was the best qualified person to be the fool for some reason.
And what's the significance of May the 1st dancing up on the hilltops with Morris?
It's kind of like the tradition.
Yeah.
That May the 1st has always been for the tradition for Morris sides to be. This is the first day we dance out in the summer. In the old days, when we were a lot younger, we used to dance at midnight on May the 1st. But as we've got a bit older, we've changed that to 7 o'clock. I mean, nobody quite knows where Morris started from, so it's been going a long time. I mean, we're, what, 62 years now, Richard?
66 years this
60,
year.
66 years going. So,
we're a revival side. Yeah. We're not one of the originals, but we were the first in Sussex. But
yeah. Right.
Morris was nearly destroyed by the First World War. The Pals battalions, which everybody knows about now, where all the people in the village joined up and went off together. They fought and died side by side.
Yeah.
And one of the oldest Morris sides, I think only one guy came back out of the whole Morris side. And the only reason he came back was because he was a blacksmith and he was so useful to the whole regiment that they didn't send him out to the front to fight. And often when they, after the war, they just didn't reform.
in the 1920s, a lot of women basically maintained the folk dancing heritage, and then gradually, as the Morris sides started to form again, generally at that point seems to have split into male sides and female sides. But there are many, many more mixed sides, and a number of sides that have both, you know, all males who dance together and all females who dance together. So it's a real old mixture now.
We always say Morris is kind of a living tradition.
Yeah.
So it adapts over the years to make it the way you want it to be. At the end of the day, it's done. We do it for fun.
Yeah.
I mean, that's you know, hopefully we have some fun doing it. And
oh, that's why we're here, isn't it?
And hopefully people who stay and watch us also, you know, have a bit of fun as well. So, I mean, this is what we do for fun, really, so.
Have you come up? You haven't come up for this? You,
yeah, we come up,
you come
every,
up every year.
Yeah, every year.
Well, how long?
We've been coming up for at least 6 years.
We've been coming up for this
years.
Morning, man. Seven or eight years, I thought.
Good way to start the summer.
Some years, there's quite a few people watching, but there's not that many this year. But it's a bit of a climb, bit of a stiff climb in the morning, midweek, especially if
you've got to put the effort in.
Yeah.
But, I was working in Bristol yesterday. I drove home last night to come here, and I'm back down there tomorrow morning, 3 a.m.
It's usually nice weather as well. I mean, the first time we came up 6-7 years ago, it was awful, wasn't it? You couldn't see anything, and we're in the clouds, heavy rain. And we thought, oh, they're not going to turn up. And you start hearing the jingles in the distance, and they came up anyway. I mean, it was just literally us, wasn't it? I mean, one other bloke.
Maybe a couple.
That was it. Yeah. It was terrible weather.
I was up here about 4 or 5 weeks ago. On my own, and there was a lady up here, and she actually walked around. I watched her walk around. She walked around 7 times, not backwards, but she walked around 7 times.
Right.
Yeah. And then she walked off. She just went off again. I didn't talk to her.
Maybe it was the devil.
Yeah.
You used to do it.
See, it's so interesting, this place up here, from the ancient kind of side of it to the flipping World War side of it, and there's been a lot going on. They keep ploughing up World War II bombs, because we had the bomb squad up just 2 weeks ago, because one of the tractors, even like 70 years later, he says, no, every year, every couple of years, we'll plough up a bomb, and then they've got to get a bomb squad in, and so there must have been some kind of ammunition or kind of storage or something that they wanted to target.
So I just want to say that in one of the pubs, hotels in Stenning, there's a picture on the wall of a poem that was written by a man from World War One, and it repeats that he can't forget about the walkway between Stenning and the Ring. And I went up there this morning to see what he was talking about. And it's a lovely view, you should go that way, and it's very spiritual. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good morning.
It was the 1st of May, and I was up long before the day. A half-inch layer of mist covered everything, the spider's webs, the dropped Stella empties, my breath. Each was coated with a milky film and a floral taste, like fresh-cut herbs. Down a twittern, I came to a park. We picnicked there the day after my grandmother's funeral, the last time my family would all gather in Stenning. Stenning, that strange town, so full of spirits, one can hardly move. Even in these tightening lanes, the seasons cycle around and around. Just outside the town, at the round hill, I watched dawn choristers flock up the downs into a dull glow of rising sun, the sky a Turner wash. I followed and could soon see in the distance the Ring, Shanktonbury Ring. It seemed to levitate between earth and sky, a holy persecution, battered and broken, its spine snapped. Since the storm, I worked to see Shanktonbury the way it once was, augmented with childhood memories, fleshed out with scores of beaches in its tight circle, a flourishing island, a atop the stark oceanic downs. It's shattered now, but if I squint, I can still see them, the ghost trees. I approached the ring and found sheep clustered within. They corralled their lambs among the trees. The mist hugged and highlighted the outlines of an ancient hill fort, and wisps of fairy-like wool snagged on the bare spring branches, dressing the trees like dream catchers, each one a memory. And I thought of Belloc as he, too, walked this place. The moon stood over Chanctonbury, so removed and cold in her silver that you might almost have thought her careless of the follies of men. Sleep came at last to me also, but that night dead friends visited me in dreams.
I love that feeling when you leave a hill and it's urging you to go.
It's like, yes. All right, you're done.
That was Justin Hopper and Sharon Krause performing a piece from their album Chanctonbury Rings. Links in the description of the podcast. I'll post a link to Justin's book, Old Weird Albion, which traces the South Downs and reveals the ghosts and spirits lurking there. I'd highly recommend it. Take it with you on your trips up into the hills, wherever you are. Thanks for a warm welcome from the Chanctonbury Morris men. I can't think of a better way to mark the start of the summer, and I look forward to next May morning. Thanks also to James Sainsbury for letting me handle some of the collection of finds from Chanctonbury Ring. Where the museum has an interesting display about Chanctonbury, and nearby Cissbury, check it out if you're visiting. Thanks for listening. Check the website, again links to that in the description. Please like and subscribe, and do get in touch if you enjoy the podcast. Goodbye for now.